Hello there, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of Cambridge Inside Out. My name's Robert Winters, and with me tonight is...
My name is Patrick Barron.
Well, hey there, Patrick. Long time no see. It's been, what, 2 weeks here? Yeah. So...
You look very clean shaven. I've decided to be the unshaven one today, but like you look very clean. Very, very, very counselor-esque.
No, really, really. Well, I'll tell you, you know, it's something that I will often do. Like usually it's around the time of my birthday, which was in May. And I'll look in a mirror and I'll go, my God, you look like an old bastard. And then I'll shave my beard off just compulsively without even thinking about it. Anyway, so just because of the playing the role of a candidate these days, you know, there were things like, well, we need a picture for to put on some brochure or something like that. So I thought to myself, my God, I don't want to put that old guy on there.
I don't know if I trust a clean-shaven Robert Winters, but all right.
Don't worry, I'll become Rip Van Winkle before you know it. You know, but anyway. So and then, by the way, that's the reason why you see some different background behind me right here too, is that I was using the computer to actually do my photography. You know, so anyway, that's why things look a little bit different here right now. So, by the way, so speaking of you know, the candidacy, so
tell us what it's like with life on the road, my friend.
I just want to be clear. I always want to emphasize my purpose is not here to promote myself on this program here right now, even though
You better start.
No. We're doing it. But but the thing is that I did want to just make a few comments about what it's like being a candidate to. You know, when you go to these various city council or school committee, I haven't been to any school committee events yet, but these candidate forums, some of them are in Zoom, some of them are in person and whatever. And it's an interesting experience. You know, I would normally recommend that everybody do it, but then we would have 100,000 candidates and that would be kind of cumbersome. So, but it is interesting, you know. One of the things I think it's worth noting is that at some of these events, actually, there was the first major one I went to was actually it was a virtual one. It was a sort of a group of organizations, the Cambridge Citizens Coalition, Indivisible Cambridge, Mid Cambridge Neighborhood Association, Harvard Square Neighborhood
Association. Stop it. Those are all one group?
No, actually, it's funny. Some people were making
Indivisible
commentary.
Cambridge?
Actually, I believe Indivisible Cambridge was formed, I think, in 2016 as sort of amongst Democrats who were really largely supporting Hillary Clinton's candidacy against Donald Trump. I could have that wrong.
Do they have special rings or a handshake? Like, I feel
left out. Everybody has their own special secret codes and privilege and executive washroom privileges. Yes, it's true. But, you know, there were some fools out there in social media who were going on about, well, this is all the same organization. I said, well, you know, there is a fair amount of intersection. I wouldn't in any way deny that. But there's another one group called Cambridge Voters for Good Government. That was formed by a few people, very independent of all of the others. I think many of them are largely motivated by some of these concerns about the charter. You know, and the potential changes to the charter, which is fundamentally different than those who are worked up about either bicycle lanes like Cambridge Streets for All, or the Cambridge Citizens Coalition, right? Where you know they're concerned more about things like historic preservation and perhaps the affordable housing overlay. Many people are opposed to that. So they're all really different, but they were all grouped together, which was interesting. And I can honestly say that, and this is actually the fun part, is that nobody cued us up to what the questions were in advance. So, you know, you sit here, you know, you make up your little, you know, your little funny cards that you're going to like, don't forget to say this and that. And then they ask you something about something completely different, right? You know, but I'm okay with that because I'm usually.
How many babies did you kiss?
I haven't kissed a single baby.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, nowadays, it's a very different world than the days of Herbert Hoover.
You probably shouldn't go kissing babies, should you? That's probably
if you kiss a baby now, you'd probably end up in jail, actually.
Yeah. Don't kiss babies.
That's not going to do that. Yeah. No.
So I have to ask you a question. So, like, I know the CCC people, and, like, there's just such a, like, a Monty Python-esque, like, gathering of different neighborhood groups. But were there any questions that you were asked that you had no idea, that you completely blank?
For me this time, no, actually. And I'll contrast that with when I was first a candidate many, many, many years ago, where that was my greatest fear, is I would go in there all primed to talk about this, that, and the other thing. And then some people who were born and raised in Cambridge were going to ask me about something, and I was going to go, where's that, man? And I would look like the big world's biggest fool. So I was fearful of that back then, but I'm not so fearful about that now. I mean, I'm probably one of the more well-informed people in the city about what's going on in the civic and political world. So I said, go ahead. I dare you. Ask me something. You know, it's like, you know, stump me. Try and stump me.
That's always been my sort of like pet peeve with counselors who run. Like, I don't think you have to, you know, you don't have to be like, you know, Mark McGovern, 12th generation, or you don't have to like have come here in the Mayflower. But I do find it puzzling when people run and they seem to not know the city at all, or they've never been in the Sullivan Chamber on a Monday night, or they've never been to a planning board hearing or a BZA hearing. And all of a sudden they know how to, you know, how to guide the city. It just kind of like feels like hubris to me a little bit.
Well, I think I actually have to agree with you about that. And I'll say that I'm not going to name names here and single people out, but the thing is there were definitely some candidates who really had no idea. And, you know, and that's all right. I mean, the thing is, you can still be a solid person, but just be unfamiliar and still be perfectly suitable for the job of being a representative, even if you're not necessarily up to speed, you know. And besides, if you have any questions, you need any backup on facts, just give me a call. I'll fill you in, right?
Likewise. But I think the rub for me, though, is like, if you look at Cambridge through like a national lens, which a lot of people who don't know Cambridge very well do, you kind of want to take a template that may seem like a national template and wedge it into Cambridge. And our problems are not, they don't align as easily. So you wind up with candidates who will say things like, well, Cambridge needs more affordable housing. And you'll say, okay, yes, great. Do you know how much affordable housing we have now? And they'll say, you know, not enough. And you're like, well, no, what's the answer? The answer is like 16 to 17% total stock. And like, oh, that's actually a lot. You're like, oh yeah, it is.
Well, actually one of the things that I was really ready to ask, because I, you know, the second major forum that I went to was, was it like only last Tuesday, or was it, or am I losing track here? But it was the one from the group that calls itself a Better Cambridge, which I've jokingly been calling a Bigger Cambridge for a long time. Actually, it's not such a joke. I think it's a more accurate description, quite honestly. Oh,
that's such a dad joke. Boo.
I know. But hey, I've been doing that joke for a long time, and I'm going to continue doing it. Thank you very much.
It's like when someone says, "You know, the Cambridge's bird is the crane," and you're like,
Well, I went to that one. I was actually in person at the Foundry, and it was interesting because. Well, let me first say this, is that I've already seen that it's like a little piece of national politics descending into Cambridge. Namely, there were some candidates, in fact, a big bunch of candidates, including a lot of incumbents, who simply would not attend the candidate forum that was put together by CCC, Indivisible Cambridge, this and that, because those are not our people. That's the other side. So I'm not going to go to that. And then there were candidates who were more inclined to be affiliated with those groups who absolutely would refuse to participate in the ABC forum. Now, I, on the other hand, being on a suicide mission sometimes, you know, I just go to them all, you know. Well, I shouldn't say I go to them all. I mean, if it was like the Our Revolution group, I just don't see any point to going to that because I'm just not a Marxist. And I'm not going to be a Marxist, and I'm not going to pretend to be a Marxist. So what the
heck? That's why I love you. But I think it's funny to me because I've always describe myself as like the Jane Goodall of Cambridge. Like, I don't feel like I've ever really fully assimilated, but I live among you and watch your ways and try to learn. and it's what's humorous to me is you have CCC, you have the Cambridge Residents Alliance, you have a Better Cambridge, and it's all the same people. But they think that they're miles apart, but they're like 2 degrees to the left, 2 degrees to the right. Like, to my mind, I can't tell the difference.
You know, there is a difference between the organization.
And by the way, Robert, I just offended so many people. So, like, don't agree with me, but like, my point was they have lots that they agree on, and it just seems like it's a little intense that they should be so at odds.
Right. Well, you know, the thing is, there's a perception of, well, let's make a distinction first between the constituencies who these organizations claim to represent, and maybe they do, maybe they don't, and the actual players who are involved. Because I can tell you, because I know, that virtually none of these organizations consists of more than that many people, really.
Right.
You know, I mean, which is not to say they don't have large mailing lists or whatever, but, you know, so, you know, the Cambridge Residence Alliance, who's sort of, I guess if there's indivisible Cambridge, they've become invisible Cambridge. They appear to be just a three older women living in Cambridge, maybe one now. Are we down to Lee Farris? Is that it? You know,
I think
there are a little bit more, because I know that when they sent around the questionnaires, I had to respond to one person who was different and whatever. So, and by the way, that was one organization where, you know, if this was years past, when I would have thought that something like Cambridge Residence Alliance were a little bit more closely affiliated with what used to be known as the Cambridge Citizens for Livable Neighborhoods, you know, an organization that sort of did not want, you know, overdevelopment and things like that, right? But, you know, right now, I mean, and I could have this wrong, and please, please disabuse me of my wrongheadedness here, if you may, but I can't really tell a difference between the Our Revolution group and the Cambridge Residence Alliance now. They seem to have converged. Maybe because one of the few members of the Residence Alliance is the landlady of Mike Connolly, who's one of the mainstays of Our Revolution, right? You know, but the point is that we're not talking about we're not talking about like mass movements here. We're talking about three people who get together over a kitchen table and decide what is what, you know. And then they'll go up to a microphone and says, I'm speaking for the Residence Alliance, whatever, as if you're actually speaking for anybody but yourself. You're not, you know. At least I have the good grace of saying I represent me.
Like the Cambridge Citizens Coalition, like they're a newer group. They, you know, I guess in terms of like multiple faces, they seem to have a pretty broad collection of people that range from young boomer to old boomer. That's a joke.
Yeah.
The Cambridge Residence Alliance, like I remember, like they used to be my nemesis, and like we would knock horns, and like ABC came out as a group in response, I think, a little bit to them. But to
that's precise. I was there at the beginning, and that's exactly how
in the room when they first named themselves, and I said, "Oh,
I actually was one of the people voting." I mean, we were both there, I think, right? Just voting on the name.
And Gus was too. Gus, the evil ice cream.
Yeah.
But like the point is, like ABC today reminds me more of Cambridge Residence Alliance back in the day. They seem to be only four.
Which, and isn't that interesting, because it came into existence as sort of the anti-Cambridge Residence Alliance, and now it's kind of hard to tell them apart sometimes.
Well, back in the day, you know, I talked to the leadership of Residence Alliance, and I say, guys, we're going to build things in the city. What do you want for housing? They say, we only want 100% affordable housing. And now you have ABC pushing the pedal to the metal on the AHO 2.0 as if it were the only solution. And then every time a new zoning proposition comes to the table, they say, well, how does this compete with the AHO? They are the 100% affordable only advocacy group.
Which, by the way, one of the things, there's a much greater incentive to learn things when you're a candidate, because partly because you're afraid somebody's going to ask you a question you don't have an answer, right? So you start looking into things more deeply than you normally would. One of the truths about that AHO 2.0 and really AHO 1.0, and it's actually right, you know, it's honestly, it's right in the, you know, the original documents for from the spring from which it came, which is that it explicitly caps height and density for all housing, except housing built by a certain subclass of nonprofit developers. So it's kind of hard for me to reconcile a stance where you say you are all for density and housing development, whatever, when in fact you're actually capping it so that only subsidized housing can be produced.
And that was the rub when AHO 1.0 passed. People were concerned that anyone but the four affordable housing developers that also run the Affordable Housing Trust, that also award themselves money from the city of Cambridge to build their projects.
Doesn't this seem just a little bit like when Enron got into the office with George W. Bush and decided to write all the energy regulations?
You're talking about affordable housing, therefore it is unlike godliness. I think the like if you put in evil Patrick Barrett and his cabal of developers, then we have a problem. So like I think that, but the fact that they were so openly concerned about that, I was like, you know, just so we're all clear, anyone can play with the AHO. That's the only way it's legal. So, but you don't really see too many private developers trying to make heads or tails of it. I do have lots of developers right now calling me, Patrick, what does this do? Can I convert? Because a lot of our market rate project, you're seeing a lot of, like Burhan posted something a little while ago about only 5 units built. And then someone had mentioned that, you know, we have 1,100 units permitted. And while that's true, and we can get into that at a later date, those permitted projects, a lot of them are being traded right now because you just can't build them. So if you can't trade the project, what you're doing is trying to figure out what does the AHO 2.0 do? And some guys are looking at that as a viable alternative.
So let's be clear. The reason you can't build them is why? Is it because the regulations written the way they are?
No.
Or is it just economics?
You have a building permit in hand, it's just economics. Right now, I can't make any project really work right now. No one can. There's some lab projects that might be viable, and you'll say, well, there's projects blasting away, Patrick. Yeah, because once you put the shovel in the ground, my friends, you're stuck. You got to go. You got money coming in, you got money going out, you're burning like fire. You got to build until you run out of money, which is what they're going to do. And then at the end of it, at the end of that project, imagine you're doing this work 2 years, 3 years into it. You have no idea what's on the other side of that. Maybe better rates. Maybe you get a tenant. Maybe you go bankrupt, you know? Maybe you hand the keys back to the bank. And a lot of that debt's non-recourse too, but this isn't a finance class, so we can move on from that point. But my point is, the AHO 2.0 has raised a few eyebrows, but it's really a lot. But it then becomes, okay, we have $140 million in the Affordable Housing Trust, and there's Fed and state money out there. How much money is really in the pot to make these viable? If I sell my project to JustaStart, will they pay $250K a unit for the land? You know? So right. Like that becomes sort of what people are trying to figure out what's going to wind up happening. And I just told them, like, there's not enough money to pay for your projects. And those groups already are at $1 million a unit to build it. So like, you know, whether if you're worried about the AHO or you love the AHO, you'd be better off like reading a book, because it's not going to really do much for you.
You know, it does strike me as sort of, again, I was raised as a mathematician, not an economist, but you know, there is this sort of reality about when you regulate things to the point where it just makes everything, it can make things just impossible. And that maybe you need to sort of rethink that, you know, just to allow a little more flexibility.
What's interesting,
and by the way, I personally don't understand. I don't even the slightest way agree with this whole concept of 100% affordable housing. I mean, for 30 years or more, we were always talking about mixed income housing and integrating housing with the neighborhoods and doing all this and that. And at some point, somebody just had a brain fart and decided that this was going to be the new policy was to just create nothing but subsidized and regulated housing. And I think it's wrongheaded.
It wasn't a brain fart. It was a coordinated effort on behalf of a few affordable housing developers who saw an in with some counselors who decided to basically draft an overlay that the entire city, which, you know, I'm not so sure that it's really an overlay anymore. But the point is, like, this was from a group of people, very specialized, and wanted to open the door for themselves, which they did. And as a person who writes zoning with some regularity for developments, I understand this. I don't begrudge this necessarily. The only thing that I was really having a problem with the AHO all along was that it removes people from the process. I love the process. I like going before the planning board and getting all heated. And I don't even mind getting yelled at by all the hippies who get mad at me and call me terrible things. It's part of the mess of development. It's what you signed up for. It needs to happen.
And having watched this for 35 years, I've seen more than my share of projects that actually became better projects as a result of all of that. So this notion that somehow the fact that there may be some public input that might alter your course is, why are you so concerned about that? I think you need to see get some psychological counseling if that bothers you, really.
There's times when I look at the planning board on the other side of the screen or in person, and I want to jump across and powerbomb them. And like, sometimes they're obtuse, sometimes they're just like, they seem like they're not even paying attention to you. But like, at the end of the day, every single one of those people are volunteers. They know what they're talking about, and they're good people. They're also people, so they're imperfect. So expecting them to be held to a high standard of flawlessness is insane. But like, there's nothing that's gone past the planning board and landed on their table that they have absolutely shot down that was a good project on the merits.
But even also the way a lot of the zoning codes were written, and I kind of wish that they had would reinvent AHO more in the spirit of the way we do special permits in the city. Yeah. That is to say, where, okay, if you just want to build a project as of right, there you go, build your project as of right. But we have this sort of greater goal for either this good design, affordability, or whatever. So as long as you meet the following criteria, we'll let you do some more. And that is the legislation that should have been passed.
That's what a special permit's all about. Hit the criteria, the specialized criteria for your special permit, you get your special permit, go.
Exactly. And that's how AHO should have been written.
The problem on the other side of that, though, Robert, and people are trying to correct it, and rightly so, is that even if you get your special permit, people would then sue you. However, the MBTA Act that just recently passed with the Baker legislation into Ely puts a very, very heavy requirement on groups trying to undo zoning and projects. You have to put, in some cases, a $50,000 retainer. Like, it used to be you could just file a lawsuit just to be fun and delay people. Now there's a consequence for it. So I think the real need for something like the AHO was diminished when that was passed.
Right. So I wish we could rewrite this, and maybe we can at some point. We'll see. Oh, by the way, it's one thing, it's only because I know it's a topic that you know a lot about, but one candidate who shall remain nameless, but you could probably guess who it is, at the ABC forum, which, by the way, for me, going to the ABC forum, where I knew that there was I've been likening it to being, Daniel in the lion's den. You're walking into a cage full of lions ready.
Those kids can't hurt you.
Tear you to shreds. Well, actually, I can tell you, I know it'll break their little ABC hearts how many people came up to me at their forum and said, "You're getting my number one." but anyway, that be that as it may. There was one candidate who, it's funny because so many of them are uninformed. This person I wouldn't say is uninformed, but they do such trash talk, and they say, we don't need any labs. We need affordable housing. I want to promote affordable housing and not labs. Now, one of the things that I did in preparation, and also because I find it interesting, I was doing some back of the envelope calculation about what actually happens when we build an affordable unit in the city. Like, let's say it's a home ownership affordable unit that you win in the lottery and do all of that. There's one, I won't give you the address here, but if you're an unregulated unit, not deed restricted in this one housing development, you pay $7,934 in property tax. This is not including the Community Preservation Act surtax, okay? If you have one of the deed restricted units, right, they're all valued at about somewhere between $176,000 and $192,000. So after the residential exemption, you know what you pay for real estate tax? About $100, right? Now, let's say every resident has city services. If they have a child, the kid's going to go to school, whatever. So baked into every one of those affordable housing units is a net cost that is permanently built into the city budget, permanently, right? And in other words, you know, building it costs is going to raid the bank, right? So how do you pay for it? Well, you transfer some of that burden to other residential taxpayers, or since 2/3 of the property tax is covered by commercial in this city, basically you build more commercial development to cover the cost. And there was a study over in Somerville that said exactly this, is that you people said, build affordable housing, damn it. And they said, yeah, if you want to do that, you're going to have to build more commercial development because it's the only way to pay for it.
So I just hate when you use logic, Robert. It just upsets me. but the candidate who will remain nameless, I thought it was interesting that this person mentioned the lab petition that was supposed to have been a groundswell from the people, and admitted on stage that it was really he and his boss who orchestrated the whole thing, which, you know, great. I'm very grateful that some of these candidates like to take credit even for things that they've never done or things that they said they haven't done. But the balance of lab and lab, just so for those three people who are currently watching,
we're under a minute, by the way.
Labs are the new office. If you eliminated labs, you would basically be condemning buildings that will never become residential to obsolescence and vacancy, and ultimately a drain, a massive drain on our tax base.
And right. And one of the main reasons I believe that the proposed lab ban went down in flames amongst our current elected officials is that somebody got to them and explained that to them.
Yeah.
And then said, listen, if you ban the labs, you're going to make all of these other initiatives impossible.
I see all these signs on people's lawn that say science is real. I want to sign this as math.
Right. Math is real. So anyway, we're down to about 10 seconds here. So anyway, we'll be back in 3 minutes.
Nice.
And we'll talk about some of the things that have been happening locally up at City Hall. See you then.